This is a Double J podcast. For copyright reasons, the music has been edited. To hear the full tracks, listen to the J Files Thursday nights on Double J, or head to doublej.net.au and click on the track list at the bottom of each episode.
Hey, it's Kaz Tran here. Welcome to the J Files, the podcast for people who love music. Each episode is like a quick music history lesson. We pick a different artist or band, we look at some of the most important moments in their career, and we celebrate their impact on music, all in less than 30 minutes. We also give you access to the Triple J archives, packed full of iconic interviews. On this episode, it's Muse, a band who raised the bar when it came to delivering an exceptional live show. The English trio have toured Australia many times over the years. They've played three big day out tours, including the headline slot in 2010, the festival's biggest ever year. And sometimes they've even toured here twice in one year, selling out huge shows at some of our biggest venues.
I think we're kind of old-fashioned in so much as we put all our effort into the real side of it, which is, I think, playing concerts and putting everything you can into your gig. And I think that people have always liked the band from what we do on stage, as opposed to, you know, more so than maybe the album even, you know. So it's a strong sort of reciprocation we have with the fans, you know. I think that that's what's kept us going, and it's sort of, you know, I think people could go away from the gig and say, oh, that's pretty good, you know, I might go back again.
It all started in the early 90s in a sleepy seaside town called Tynmouth in Devon, England. Three high school friends formed a band. But as frontman Matt Bellamy told Triple J in 2004, this band didn't go by the name of Muse.
We were all in the same school together and that kind of thing, and we were just kind of in bands just to, you know, because we were bored, there's nothing else to do really, I suppose, in the town where we came from. So.
And was Gothic Plague the original name for the band?
that was the first band that I was in Don with. Chris was in a different band called Fixed Penalty, and then I left that band and joined a band called Carnage Mayhem. But eventually, they all split up, and we ended up together, and we were called Rocket Baby Dolls first, but then we changed it after because we were kind of dressed up in this kind of gothic weird makeup, and we did this like competition, and we won this competition, and we didn't expect to win it because we were just taking a piss, you know, we weren't really taking it seriously, and because we won it, we thought maybe we should give it actually a serious go, so we changed the name to a neutral Muse.
And do you miss the days of the goth makeup and the much more metal names?
It's kind of still inside us somewhere, you know, like, that kind of, you know, that goth's in there somewhere, I reckon, waiting to come out.
During this chat with Mel Bampton, Matt Bellamy spoke about the artists who influenced him growing up. From Rage Against the Machine to Queen to Jimi Hendrix, it was an eclectic mix.
Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child. What was it about that track that you found such an inspiration?
When I was probably about 13, up until that point I'd been playing mostly the piano, and I kind of wasn't really, I wasn't really that into the guitar, the idea of playing guitar. I played like a little bit of guitar, but just a couple of chords. It wasn't until I saw a video of, I think it was Live in Monterey, I think, the one where he sets fire to the guitar and all that lot. His craziness on stage, I was about 13, it was the first time I'd ever seen that kind of thing, and it just kind of made me see the dangerous element in what, you know what I mean? And I found it reasonably, you know, attractive to get. So I picked up the guitar and started trashing guitars very quickly after that.
Well, you are renowned for doing that, and I was hoping that you'd do that on Monday night at the Metro, but there was no trashing of gear. What's going on? You're mellowing out?
I don't know if you're mellowing out. I think it's like, I think we trashed so much gear that we kind of lost so much money that we had to knock it on the head. And so I decided to design these guitars that were so expensive that I'd never risk breaking them. Do you know what I mean?
So you're not going to go down the road of Jimi Hendrix and set any of them on fire anymore, are you?
You never know. I mean, you know, we'll see. I think it's possible. Anything's possible. I mean, we've done all sorts of stuff on stage. I mean, I remember once pushing an entire 8x12 stack into Chris. He dodged out of the way and ended up falling all over the mixing desk and stuff, and cost so much damage that we got banned from ever hiring gear in the Eastern Europe area.
Oh, yeah. Just a small section of the world. Yeah. And how did Chris take to this? Was he a bit pissed
off?
Well,
luckily he dodged out of the way. I mean, there's been a couple of times when I've swung a guitar around my head and nearly taken his chops off, you know. And I think, I don't know, it's not really calming down. It's more a case of just looking out for health and safety a little bit.
Getting responsible. Yeah. Well, another band that you've chosen a song from is Rage Against the Machine, who also love their guitars. The track Freedom, why this one of all their back catalogue?
Oh, I think it's just the riff at the end. It's just got this really amazing, cool, simple riff at the end, and it kind of goes into this double time, and it's just like the ultimate mosh pit, you know, ending to any song. And I remember it was probably the first mosh pit I got beaten up in so much so, you know, that I ended up having to crowd surf my way out just to kind of get a bit of relief from the bruises. I think there's a band that maybe, you know, get into the more hard edge of rock music, you know. And obviously Tom Morello is just like a genius guitarist as well. He's kind of the opposite of Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix is all kind of just emotion and improvisation, and Tom Morello is really kind of clinical and these kind of really hard straight riffs, you know. And I kind of they're kind of opposites, you know. But I like them both for different reasons. Mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has a devil put aside. My dad was kind of more into blues and country, that kind of thing, but my mum was a little bit loose on the side, and she was a bit of a maniac Queen fan. I used to come into like the dining room where we had this like stereo and find her late at night boozed up on a couple of bottles of wine, just like listening to like Bohemian Rhapsody or something, and trying to explain to me the power of music, you know, and this kind of, you know, and it's kind of all a bit embarrassing. I didn't really get it until I was a bit older. But I saw the video of We Are the Champions. I don't know if you've seen it. Have you seen it where he wears that outrageous catsuit?
Yeah, it's, yeah, he's, oh, Freddie and Mercury looks like a very frightened man. Yeah. We Are the Champions.
It's so outrageous. I just had to get into it from that point onwards, and the whole kind of piano guitar thing as well. That was the first time I really heard that kind of thing. So it's more for my mum though, I suppose, because one of my mum's favourite bands. You know, she's into this kind of cheesy stuff.
Well, other than Queen, what else did your parents bestow on you musically? Like, obviously, it was a lot broader than that for you to turn out the way that you have.
That was about as cool as my mum got, you know. I mean, outside of that, it was you know, ABBA and then, you know, Tina Turner, that, you know, it got into that kind of area. My dad was slightly more kind of cool, you know. He was listening to blues stuff like Robert Johnson, Ray Charles, that kind of thing, Stevie Wonder. So my dad was more into the soul side of things.
And what did they think about you taking such early footsteps on the road to rock? Were they okay with it?
They were fine with my dad. Was a musician when he was my age anyway. He was in a band, and so he kind of knows the lifestyle and all that kind of thing, and he kind of used to go, yeah, go on son, you'll have a good time, that kind of thing. My mum was slightly more worried. She was kind of always taking me aside going, don't do drugs, don't touch those drugs, those you know, the druggies on tour and all this kind of thing, you know. So my mum was kind of slightly less accepting of it, but my dad was fine. He was kind of, you know, he knew what it was all about. So,
well, what about now though? Like now, I mean, did they ever envisage that this is where you'd be? You'd be touring the world with your band, and from 10 years ago, 11 years ago when you first started, have they chilled out? Has your mum chilled out especially with where
you're at? Oh yeah, I brought her to a gig for the first time only about a year ago actually, because I was kind of too embarrassed getting my parents along to gigs in the early days because I thought they'd have just disowned me if they saw me trashing gear and all that kind of thing. So there's only like this recent arena gig I did in Manchester. I got my mum to come along, and she actually loved it completely, and she saw the Queen connection there, so she kind of
Muse had been popular in Australia since their very first album, Showbiz, in 1999. Things started to take off around the world with their second record, Origin of Symmetry, and then exploded with Absolution in 2003. Absolution was their first number one record in the UK, and it was the first to make headway in the US. They teamed up with producer Rich Costey, who cut his teeth working with legendary composer Philip Glass. It's the album that helped Muse fully realise just how epic their stadium rock could be. Here's Matt Bellamy talking to Mel Bampton about the making of Absolution.
I think when we first started out, we were going to do the whole orchestration thing like on almost everything. You know, I think we wanted to push it over the limit, over the edge of what was acceptable, I think. But we kind of did the string arrangements for a couple of songs. They came out really crap, so we just kind of knocked it on the head and decided to take a more minimal rock approach on most of the albums. Because we thought Butterflies and Hurricanes and Blackout were so kind of I mean, I think those songs work really well with the strings, but I think they're kind of so overdone that they kind of, you know, the rest of the album had to just contrast those two songs, you know.
And how much is it a collaborative affair in the songwriting process of Muse?
What, you mean how we write songs?
Yeah, together.
I mean, music-wise, this album was very much a collaboration compared to the past. I think on the first album, I was kind of just writing songs, you know, purely about personal life experience, that kind of thing. I mean, lyrics, I still do all the lyrics and everything, but the music was kind of just through working together. We'd go into a rehearsal room and just I'd have a selection of riffs and ideas and chord structures, and they'd kind of say, that's crap, that's good, whatever, and add something else into it. And it was kind of a lot of it just came from mixing our own ideas together, you know.
And you've got a few organic noises coming through on this one as well. Diving in a pool in Thoughts of a Dying Atheist. Was there any? How did that come about? And are there any other noises in there?
Whenever you go to, we always like recording in like residential studios, like out in the countryside somewhere. And I think whenever you go to a studio, you always got to like use as much as the local stuff you can, like the rooms, all the bits lying around the kind of local area. And the area we was in the countryside in Ireland, and there was like loads of old kind of wagon wheels lying around and all this kind of thing, and it was like a big, it happened to be a massive swimming pool there as well, it wasn't like a massive, you know, expensive rock and roll luxury, it just happened to have a pool there, you know, it wasn't, so we thought we had to use it because the sound in there was, you know, the big kind of reverberation sound, and we were kind of trying to create like a big intro to the album with all this kind of stamping and this kind of thundering of drums and everything. We put Dom in a nappy and put him in the pool and floated a couple of bass drums and just kind of, he was a bit drunk at the time. And we just recorded him hitting drums randomly and kind of layered it up and up and up, just Dom floating around in a nappy in a swimming pool. The reason he was in a nappy was because Chris's kids were there, sorry.
And, right, okay.
Chris's kids were there, yeah, he's got three kids now.
And, so there's no, a few nappies, that explains
lying,
it,
there's a few
right.
nappies lying around, and we were a bit drunk, and Dom, you know, he just looked, we had to just dress him up and see what happened.
Producer Rich Costey working on this album as well. He recently produced the Mars Volta album too, so he's certainly not someone who's unfamiliar with this epic kind of sound.
Yeah.
How much of a crucial part did he play in the overall vision?
Oh, he's great, you know. He's his part was probably kind of honing us in and keeping us from going off on one too far, you know. But he himself, he's worked with loads of experimental artists, like you said, Mars Volta, and one of the main reasons, and also he mixed a couple of Rage Against the Machine albums. But one of the main reasons why I picked to work with him is because he worked with Philip Glass. He did a double album by him called Civil War. Which is a massive epic kind of symphonic thing. So he had a lot of experience with working with that kind of side of music as well. So he seemed like the ideal guy to work with. So he sort of taught us a lot about how to record strings and how to, you know, deal with that, you know, how to make those sounds work with a rock band, you know.
Well, it is a lot more polished, this album. Is that the way that you want to stay?
I don't know. I think we'll always experiment with new ideas, you know. I'm not necessarily sure if we'll completely go off on one and disappear into a completely different genre or something, but I think every album we've ever done has always got a few different, you know, production techniques and a few different types of ideas on them, and I think we'll probably continue with, like, just exploring new ideas that way, you know.
In 2007, Muse were back in Australia. First for the big day out in January, and then again in November for a string of stadium shows. It was the year Knights of Cydonia took out the Triple J Hottest 100, just nudging Silverchair's Straight Lines from the top spot. Here's Matt Bellamy and drummer Dominic Howard talking to Robbie Buck about the band's ever-increasing success.
I think our ambitions have always been pretty short-term, really. I think, you know, or simplistic, maybe. I think when we were in school and stuff, it was just like, you know, I just want to go on tour. You know, that was like a dream come true. It was just a, you know, stepping foot on your first tour bus or something and just getting out and not having to paint and decorate for money. You know, that was dream come true. So really, it's all been a bit of a laugh since I was about 18, really. So I think everything's been a pleasure, and it hasn't really been a careerist, if you know what I mean. I think we've just taken it all as it comes. I think we've adjusted to playing these larger venues through Fluke. At first, we weren't really that comfortable with playing the large arenas because it was just three of us, and because, you know, we didn't have a sort of traditional sort of front man running around doing all the, you know, getting everyone clapping and everything. So we kind of accidentally found ourselves in this position, but it's a lovely place to be.
Yeah. Look, I read an article about you, and it was in an English music press, so it might be complete rubbish, but they were talking about your staging actually was drawn from some secret government site of some sort in North America. Is that true, the harmonic...
Yeah, the harp. Yeah,
the harp.
High frequency active rural research program. Yeah, it's some that was the staging that we used for Wembley. Yeah, it was like all these kind of antennas that they use for. I can't remember what it's used for. Nobody knows what it's used for, but it's like some mysterious thing they have in Alaska that they think is some kind of new weapon that can control the weather. You know, they think that it can manipulate the weather. You know,
but they say it's just a communications.
They say it's a communications device for communicating with submarines, but it's based on some bunch of patents by Tesla. You know, that guy called Nikola Tesla who invented a bunch of ways of manipulating the weather and superheating the ionosphere to create mind control and all this kind of stuff, you know. But no one knows if it's true or not. But I mean, you know, I'm interested in those kind of mysterious areas, the unknown. You know, I don't necessarily believe it all, but I mean, I'm interested.
Yeah, because you do have a reputation for being into it. You know, how far into it do you go? Do you do a lot of research?
Yeah, I think I got into it just because the kind of books I like to read. I just like to read books written by people that are a bit on the edge, you know. I like reading sort of like people like David Icke, you know, these kind of people.
He's the alien guy that we're all lizards amongst us.
I like trying to sort of get inside these people's minds and see if I actually do believe they're mad or not, or whether they're just like, you know, the, you know, whether. Yeah, where they might be onto something. You know, I think a lot of these people, they're half of them is actually they've got a lot to say. You know, a lot of really good points, and then half of it's a little bit on the edge. You know, a bit of madness. You know, I'm not sure why. I just find myself reading like those kind of books, and I think that's the reason I've got into it. Really. You know.
How do you react to it, Dominic? Are you into it as well?
I'm sure. Yeah, but
has it been spreading.
I haven't read as much as Matt about this kind of thing. You know, and I guess you know it's the furthest he's ever gone is, you know, the Queen's a lizard or something like that. But, you know, in our private time, you know, behind closed doors, you know, we can probably take it very far between us. But, you know, yeah, I mean, you know,
do you?
It's still sometimes in discussions.
It's one of those things, you know, you can go really far with it. You know, you can if you start to think about these things in depth, you start to realise that everything that you know you've learnt from, you know, from school and from the media and from various books, and you can to an extent say that everything you know is actually, you know, could be false. You don't really know. I mean, so I think it is possible to be too open-minded, definitely.
So do you try and put do you consciously put some of your opinions about conspiracy theories and the like into
the songs?
Yeah. Well, into the songs and the way you present yourself, you know.
There's a handful of songs that I think that I try to get a bit more down to earth with it when it comes to music. I think songs like Take a Bow and maybe City of Delusion, Assassin to an extent, well, maybe not. But definitely, yeah. I think those songs kind of deal with more this is what the sort of conspiracy is about, you know, the kind of corporate agenda which is controlling our governments and how there's no real democracy and all that kind of stuff, you know, which is a bit more down to earth than spacemen and lizards, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I know that you have a great suspicion about control in terms of, you know, societal control and stuff. But do you guys actually, in your everyday lives, do you, and I guess in the position that you are in a fairly major touring band, do you actually resist in any ways, you know, the control that is placed on you?
From who?
I've read you talking about the government, basically, you know, maintaining control in terms of having ID cards and all those sorts of things. I mean, do you have any sort of like passive resistance or anything that you'd like to throw in?
I think the iris tests. Where you get the iris scan.
Yeah, they brought in these iris things
can't
now.
Do
yeah,
that,
and yeah, so. Unfortunately, I think what they're going to do is they're going to make it so that everything you have to do becomes you have a choice to either queue up for an hour. Or like, you know, get an ID card and an iris scan, and you'll go straight through. You know, I think that they'll get us to conform in that way. But I think we should be afraid of those kind of things because of it depends on if you trust the police, if you trust the government, you trust the army, you trust the politics. If you trust them all 100%, you think there's no bent people in those organisations, then go ahead with it. But all it takes
what an
is
offer.
Yeah, but all it takes is one sort of dodgy copper. Do you know what I mean? Do you call them coppers ever? Yeah, it takes one dodgy copper to have access to all that kind of information, and they can just frame anyone they want for any crime, you know, just to make themselves look better. And I think that it's something to be worried about, and also it's just further ways of sort of marginalising and controlling people and keeping us living in fear. I mean, the news is just, you know, you've probably heard it all before, but the news is just like constantly bombarding everyone with being scared of like things that are really ridiculous, like terrorism. I mean, you know, you're far more likely to get knocked over by a car than you are to get blown up by a terrorist. I mean, but everyone, you know, in the modern world, everyone's always walking around thinking, oh, we're going to get
attacked by this, that and the other, and it's all just bollocks. You know? Muse's music is pretty big in the way that you put it together, and your stage shows are very big. And I know that, you know, the word prog gets thrown around with you guys a little bit as well. At what point is there a line that you are conscious about not to go overboard, where, you know, you can fall into self-parody, or you become just...
Well, I think there's a line. You always draw a line, but you always end up crossing
cross
it. Yeah. whatever you draw, you always cross it. Yeah, because just by the
just
nature
to
of
test the water, to see what it's like.
Yeah. In what way? Where
well, I think there's lines. I'm not sure if we've gone quite into full. Like, we haven't got the spandex out yet. You know, I think that's one line that I'm not prepared to cross. I think musically, we're pretty open. You know, I think we're not afraid if some songs do have a slight tongue-in-cheek edge to them. You know, and verge on the you know, so over the top that it can be perceived by some people as ridiculous. I mean, I think there's definitely an element of that in some songs. There's also I think where you cross the line in a more weirder way is songs like Supermassive Black Hole, which take more from other genres like dance music or R&B music, which I think is probably a bigger surprise for someone who's associated with kind of prog rock to do something like that. You know, I think that becomes the sort of unusual step, is doing something like that.
Yeah, and what about on the stage show? I mean, have you had any Stonehenge moments that you've had to?
On Wembley Stadium, actually. On Wembley Stadium, we were the beginning of the gig, we came out in the middle of the crowd on this sort of electronic podium that sort of, not electronic, it was sort of, what do you have?
Hydraulic,
yeah, that pushes up like that, and we were stuck on it. And so it was pure spontaneity, we couldn't get up, and we were sort of sat there. It was the first gig, actually, the first night, and we all stood there like this, with all the crowd around us, just waiting to go up, feeling like a right bunch of, you know, fucking dicks. And it was like the worst, like, we were already shitting ourselves, you know what I mean? And then being stuck on that for like an extra 3 minutes, just waiting for it to move. Like, stood like that. That was pretty...
Felt like hours.
That was pretty embarrassing, yeah. It felt like hours, yeah.
Do you normally get nervous before a gig? How do you feel? I mean, we were only a few hours before you hit the stage and there's, what, 12,000 people out there going a little bit crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it's all right now. I mean, we're fine now because we've been a few hours, but, you know, just before we go on stage... Someone in the band will say, "I can't do this," you know, and that kind of just moves around.
Like an hour before, like you do get that moment of like, "I just don't know if I can do this." You know, I don't know how I got myself into this position, like where I've got to go on there and try and remember all these lyrics, all these parts, and everything, and like somehow entertain 12,000 people. And I just don't know if I can do it. You know what I mean? And like, so yeah, but I think it's just nerves that get to you like that. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, we always get nervous. It usually kicks in about an hour to half an hour before the gig, and you can't avoid it. It's when you, yeah. And but as soon as you step on the stage, something takes over. You know what I mean? And it, just all the nerves disappear.
As the music became grander, Muse's fan base became bigger and more passionate, especially here in Australia. When they headlined the Big Day Out for the second time in 2010, it was the festival's biggest year on record. Muse had risen from promising Radiohead acolytes to prog rock behemoth. It was a far cry from the humble high school band you heard Matt Bellamy talking about before. When Lindsay McDougall spoke to Dom and Matt during the 2010 Big Day Out tour, they shared the story of what brought them together.
We were from different gangs, really, in school, weren't we? Different groups of friends.
Yeah. I suppose I was kind of listening to kind of indie rock music or something like that. Matt used to hang around with a different gang of people that wasn't really in our gang.
Didn't listen to anything.
Didn't listen to music. And
yeah, we should go down the arcade and
yeah,
you play just, games, you know, play
and bang, more bang the machines to get some money out, that kind of stuff. But I saw Matt play some music in like the school assembly and thought he was a really good musician. So I was in a band at that time, so I asked him to join our band because our guitarist was a bit whack.
And Dom taught me how to play the guitar. He taught my first few guitar chords, so you could say Dom was a boss, really, in a way.
Yeah, well.
But things changed very quickly.
Yes, I take your lesson. Oh, and now the student has become the master. So it's funny that you say video games and music were the two sort of separate pastimes, because I guess that kind of, you know, the Muse sound, which is like Space Invaders set to music kind of thing. Sort of appropriate. So when you were playing at school assembly, was that something that, you know, was like a music class thing, or was it just a...
Yeah, it's like a talent contest or something. And I was actually playing the piano. It's just like a solo piano thing with a bunch of other people. And but I wasn't really a guitar player at that point. Mm-hmm. But there was some girl I really wanted to get off with, and I couldn't get her at all. And after I played that piano thing, she was up for it.
That's brilliant.
And so I thought music might be a good vocation to pursue. I wasn't really that good at school, to be honest. I was reasonably good at maths. I suppose I would have gone on to do something pretty boring, actually. But music, I'm glad I took music instead. And then when Dom asked me to play the guitar and be in his band, I thought, well, that's perfect. You know, let's do that. Because they were doing gigs and stuff. And I was just on my own playing piano, so I didn't really have anywhere to go. So I thought I'd learn the guitar and try and get into rock music.
Yeah. And if piano gets you one girl, then a guitar.
Exactly.
Let's face it. Yeah. The amount of people who were supposed to be, who have been like bunking off piano lessons this afternoon that have just raced to their piano teacher's house right now is just amazing. And it obviously paid off, you know, when you were called the Rocket Baby Dolls. Actually, Sam from the Blue Mountains wanted to know about that Battle of the Bands contest, what sort of music you played and stuff.
That was actually our first gig.
It wasn't a million miles away, really, was it, from what we're doing? The kind of music we started off doing was...
Yeah, it was...
We were kind of
experimental and a bit, you know, the songs were quite long, probably, and the arrangements a bit weird, and it was lots of like different shifts and a bit more prog, I suppose. But that's actually our first gig, and we played the only six songs that we had, and then we smashed up all the gear at the end of the concert, and I think we kind of looked a bit
weird. Wasn't our gear,
actually. Yeah, it was like some kind of rental.
there was some band that was like real kind of like, you know, they really fancied themselves. They were like the really great musicians playing sort of funk and this kind of music.
And they're normally the people that win these bands, and they
supplied the gear. It's really weird because they were like in their sort of late 20s, and all the rest of the bands were like teenagers, like 15, 16, and they were sort of like, oh, you can use our gear if you want.
You know, so little has changed in band competitions. There's still a funk band at every band competition.
Yeah. So there's always one, isn't there? Yeah.
They thought they were so good.
they were so pleased.
And who won? It was nice and tight and slick, yeah, but then we won.
Hey!
Because we had some attitude, man.
And they were very disappointed with that, I think.
Oh, they were?
Yeah.
It was their gear. They could have just...
Exactly. I think they organised it. But I think they organised it to sort of demonstrate to everyone around them that how good they were. But unfortunately, it didn't quite work out.
Didn't work out.
All right.
It's cool, though.
That's great. I want to talk about the Illuminati, and I want to talk about shape-shifting lizard men and all that sort of stuff. Because the bass player in my band's quite a fan of that stuff, in that he believes that the Illuminati control the world. I don't know how far he goes along the line of shape-shifting lizard men, but you guys don't mind entertaining those notions, at least in song.
Entertaining is the key word, yeah.
What is it about that sort of stuff?
It's funny, isn't it? It's quite weird.
I noticed Lady Hawk, who is at the Big Day Out, she's been targeted by the anti-Illuminati internet police because apparently she's got imagery in her video clips.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How have you guys gone in that respect?
There's one move that I put on stage that I think some people have referred to as a Illuminati symbol. Yeah.
Right.
Is that one? You know that one there? That's the rock sign?
The devil horns.
Some people associate that with the others.
The others, is that what they're called?
I don't know.
There's videos showing you George Bush doing this and George Bush Jr. doing this.
You've gone down the slippery slope.
Well, I find it interesting. it's very interesting because it is, you know, so many people believe it. And like, do you guys run into any problems with people thinking that you are sort of aligning yourself with these people who are fighting the New World Order and stuff?
Well, it's the opposite, actually. We're aligning ourselves with the New World Order. I've managed to get myself involved into that whole scene. I've done a lot of research into it. Mm-hmm. And the deeper you go, the darker you go, you actually realise you actually are one of them.
Right.
And because you start to learn the mind control tricks that these people use. You know?
Of course
it's very, very straightforward, actually.
How far into the resistance?
So I've actually used those skills in order to help this band become more popular. And in the process of doing that, you end up becoming one of those. So you end up becoming what you hate.
Right.
But actually, you have a lot more fun. It's less paranoia and it's a bit more enjoyable lifestyle.
Matt Bellamy being a little bit tongue-in-cheek talking to The Doctor back in 2010. Yes, Muse have explored some big issues in their music. Politics, government, humanity and technology, new intergalactic frontiers. Even in their darkest and most defiant moments, they've held on to a sense of humour and curiosity. Muse have set the agenda for what it means to be a rock band shooting for greatness in the modern era. The J Files is a Double J podcast. Make sure you like, subscribe and share, and you can always leave a comment and let us know who you'd like us to feature on the show. Our producer is Gab Burke, with production support from Phoebe Bennett and Sam Wicks. Theme music is by Art vs. Science, and you can check out Double J anytime on the Triple J app or at doublej.net.au. I'm Kaz Tran. Catch you next time.